Chapter 3, The Third Principle. My child's greatest need is acceptance. Because my children are so different from one another, I had to learn to question my assumptions and expectations about their behavior and what they each needed from me, understanding that neither of their temperaments was right or wrong. When my daughter was born, 4.5 years after my son, I literally had to start over. The expectations I held for my son did not fit my daughter. Her behavior was a complete mystery to me. She brought me to my knees and taught me how difficult this job of parenting really is. I had to learn to listen to my children rather than to the myriad voices around me. That meant paying attention. I learned that who they are was already there. We didn't have much to do with it, but my husband and I had everything to do with what directions their temperaments took. The hardest thing for me to learn was to stand back and trust, and to make sure my needs got met as well. My son was the easygoing, extroverted, happy-go-lucky, social kid who made me feel like a fabulous parent. My daughter wanted it her way, put up a fight until things felt fair, looked at the world through a serious lens, didn't express her feelings readily, and was a one-friend-at-a-time girl. She made me question everything I thought I knew. Casey was adjustable wherever we went. Molly dug in her heels and didn't like change. My son's perception of the world seems to me widespread and accommodating. My daughter's has strict standards and delves to depths I can't begin to touch. They needed different aspects of me, and my job was to come up with what they needed without sacrificing myself. It would have made life easier to use my accommodating son to compensate for my daughter. "Just let her have it," was the phrase I made sure I never used. Casey would have accommodated, but I knew he would have resented her for it. I would have been justified in many eyes to use punitive tactics with my daughter to get her to give up her fight, but then I would have raised a monster. Both were challenges and tried my patience, but I did not try to make them any different from who they are. Both are strong and secure and have always had respect and love for each other. Unconditional acceptance. Unconditional love is the right of every child. Acceptance of the whole child is essential to nurturing each child's potential. Sounds good, but how many of us really know what that means? Chances are, if you experienced unconditional love and acceptance as a child, you understand. Probably you don't even question it. Unfortunately, few of us did, which makes it harder to give it to our children. To determine the amount of unconditional love you received, ask yourself, did I believe that I would be loved and accepted no matter what? Or, was I afraid that if I didn't behave a certain way, I would be a disappointment? Did my opinions and beliefs matter to my parents? Or, did I learn that what mattered to me did not matter to my parents? Was I free to seek what I wanted in life? Or, was it clear that I needed to make my parents proud and follow a path they wanted? Acceptance is even more important to a child's healthy development than love. We can love our children but not accept them. But it's hard to wholly accept our children without loving them. Unconditional love requires acceptance of this individual being and what he brings to the world, no matter what the temperament, type of energy, brain circuitry, learning style, gender, or hair color. Acceptance means that my child does not have to be like me or think like me, or his brother. He's free to have his own needs and to hold different perceptions, beliefs, and opinions. He may need to live a very different life than the rest of the family. Too many children give up when they know they will never live up to their parents' expectations, or they keep trying for that elusive approval by doing what they think they should instead of what they want. Either choice cripples potential. What will people think? When parents care more about what grandparents, in-laws, even total strangers would say than what their child needs, what will they think becomes the fear that blocks unconditional acceptance. The pressure's on to raise children society approves of, whatever the parents' interpretation. What it boils down to is that parents take their children's behavior personally and view it as a reflection of themselves. The almighty they determines their self-worth. Under that pressure, parents exert control over their children's thinking and behaving in order to gain their approval, even though that approval might not be in the best interest of their child. Parents who fear criticism or ridicule by friends and family often misunderstand many children who are on the outside edges of the temperament continuum, impulsive or aggressive behavior, or shy and withdrawn qualities. The children who have the best chance of positively contributing to society are those whose unique potential has been allowed to blossom. The children who are supported and accepted as they are, while disciplined to live respectfully within a community, will be our greatest assets. But when parents feel bound to parent as others think they should, they become trapped and their children lose out. The strong-willed children will fight that control, push their buttons, and provoke daily power struggles to defend themselves against being pressured into someone they're not. And the easygoing, adaptable children will succumb to the pressure, do as their parents wish, and lose their own way. Quote-unquote bad kids are usually the product of confused, exhausted, frustrated parents under pressure. Fearing what will become of their children, they try everything inconsistently before giving up. Instead, we need to change course, use a different parenting language than we're used to, and trust our children's individuality. It's essential for parents to understand that years of scientific evidence concludes that we as parents can only influence, never change, genetic inborn personality traits. In Nurture the Nature, Michael Gurian says that, quote, studies now show that personality and temperament, including whether a child is extroverted or introverted, aggressive or shy, styles of walking, talking, and running, even physical and mental strengths and disorders, are in large part inborn, end quote. He cites the National Institute of Mental Health as having discovered, quote, genetically activated brain mechanisms that are responsible for children's social behavior, end quote. Every inherited trait is activated differently within each child's genetic system to create the amazing individual uniqueness of the human race. We as parents can help or hinder our children's path to success, but we cannot pave it. It's there at birth. Individual success must not be measured by how well a child complies with the values of the adult world, but by how well the child's individual qualities and attributes are accepted and find purpose in that world. It begins with acceptance in the family. The "I've tried everything and nothing works" parent. Kristen was at her wit's end with 10-year-old Josh. She described him as a mostly loving, funny, independent kid who really wants to get life right but wants everyone to see things his way. He has a quick temper that he takes out on everyone in the family. Kristen said he's vicious to his little brother, fantastically rude, shouts at everyone, and most alarming, has recently started to use physical violence, throwing things at people, and actually frightening me. He's very big for 10. I'm very frightened of violently expressed anger. He has actually said that he enjoys seeing me scared. He hits me and tells me to shut up. When I try to discipline him or tell him he can't hit his brother or me or say these awful things, he becomes enraged. I've tried everything and nothing works, from ignoring him to grounding him to direct confrontation and screaming at him to physically pushing him out of the room. Kristen really believed there was nothing left to do. The problem is that Kristen's everything is either control or withdrawal, nothing in between. It's hard to see the behavior of a child like Josh as a signal to a deeper need crying out to be heard. When violence is the child's outcry, a parent's temptation is to retaliate and meet it head-on, stopping it at all costs. There are no attempts to understand what he's trying to say. Josh's only choice is to keep on with louder and more dramatic behavior. His parents can only focus on his misbehavior, so he doesn't know how to change. Josh is learning that he's a problem. He likely feels afraid of his anger and aggressive impulses, since his parents have always rejected them, so he uses them as protection. Saying that he enjoys seeing his mother scared is most likely a defense, his protection against revealing his pain. He can't lose face at this point in his game, admit that he's hurting, or that what he wants most is his parents' love and acceptance. Perhaps he thinks if he takes the controlling position, he can avoid being controlled. Josh needs to be believed in and trusted even more now than ever. He's gotten off track and needs a great deal of help getting back on. Kristen needs assurance that violence is not the track he wants to be on, even though it may look that way. Sometimes it requires a leap of faith to turn things around. Learning to accept. Josh is not so far off track yet that his mother has not been able to describe him as funny, loving, and independent. Aggressive tendencies in a child are often difficult to accept because we typically project or catastrophize them into fights, school detentions, jail sentences, and serial killings in a split second. But aggressiveness, when guided with acceptance and rechanneling the physical aspects, can be a positive characteristic. Society's most influential and powerful people did not reach their goals with smiles and kindness alone. We cannot determine our child's temperament and potential, nor can we change it. We can, however, influence it strongly and even determine the direction it will take. Acceptance is the best nourishment we can give. But when we think our children's future is our responsibility to determine, we must control it, an impossible task and a never-ending source of frustration and exhaustion. Josh's parents need a new perspective on aggressiveness. They must set their expectations for a child who has a lot of angry energy that needs acceptable channeling, not for a child who is calm and submissive. To begin, they need to simply protect themselves, him, and anyone or anything else from harm, saying as little as possible during his outbursts. After the outburst, the roots need attending. A response could be, "You seem furious. I'm even here today. You must be very frustrated by what I'm saying. Life must look pretty bad to you right now." This acknowledges his anger instead of raging at it or being cowed by it. When Josh screams at his mother to shut up, the best thing to do is wait out his storm as neutrally as possible and talk to him when he's calmer. Nothing can be accomplished when a child or a parent is in high gear. Kristen must wait for a window of opportunity to connect, to find something to put positive focus on, and to appeal to his hurting self. She can focus on his aggression and determination in a positive way when it's not being used hurtfully. "Josh, you have such strong ideas of how things should be. Even though it makes life frustrating for you and probably always will, I have no doubt you will use your ideas to make something wonderful happen someday. The world needs your kind of mind." Chapter 6 will explore more ways a child's aggression and determination can be focused on positively. His parents need to see Josh as that loving, funny, independent boy more often, who's presently expressing his frustration through anger and physical aggression. When they see him that way, he will too. It's a shift in perception that brings about compassion for the hurt child inside. Whenever that funny, loving kid shows up, that's the time to give lots of positive, loving notice, physical affection, and connection. Acceptance as mirroring. When our children are not doing as we ask, appear resistant at every turn, and become manipulative and sneaky, it's difficult to acknowledge that it may be us and the messages we're sending that require change. Instead, we see disrespect, disobedience, rudeness, and defiance. Our children determine their identities by seeing themselves as we see them. We are their mirrors. If what they see is troublemaker, brat, disappointment, monster, dumb, violent, lazy, their particular temperament will either submit to that perception or fight it every step of the way. The problem is that the more they fight, the more we perceive them negatively, and the less we're able to understand their behavioral clues. Every child deserves a mirror that reflects her greatness, her uniqueness, her most positive attributes. The child identifies herself with the attributes she sees reflected and doesn't question the mirror, only herself. Eyes like water. Imagine your eyes like the surface of water. When you're calm, seeing your child with the perspectives presented here, your eyes are like still water. In that stillness, your child can see himself clearly. He sees who he really is. But when fear, anger, resentment, or other reactive emotions take over, your eyes become like water in a storm with rough waves and whitecaps. Your child cannot see himself in that turbulent water. What he sees is turbulence. Dorothy had to call on all her patience to parent her 5-year-old daughter, who always needed things to be just so. Sophie's perfectionism meant that she was slow and methodical and rarely would change how she did anything once she got it the way she liked it. Dorothy was often on Sophie's case to just hurry up. It doesn't matter if you write every letter with a different color. You're taking forever, and I don't have the time for this. Dorothy assumed that Sophie refused to try any other way and was trying to make her mother mad. Dorothy was on edge whenever Sophie got involved in one of her projects. Dorothy shared in our class one day that she thought Sophie was afraid to try anything new in case it wouldn't turn out to be what she envisioned. She feared that Sophie's stubbornness to change her ways would cause her trouble in school and on down the line. She wished that Sophie would just ease up, let things go, and be a kid. She would often tell her, "Just let it roll off your back. Sophie will be so much happier that way." But Dorothy didn't understand what made Sophie happy. After discussing this problem in class, Dorothy realized she was not accepting Sophie's intense attention to detail as part of her temperament and personality. She thought with effort she could get Sophie to change. I told Dorothy to ask Sophie what she would want to change about herself if she could. Sophie initially said she wished she were 6 and could fly. Then she said that she would want 10 arms, 4 sets of eyes, and 1 mouth. She said that they would help her be faster and not lazy. Dorothy said, "You could have hit me with a ton of bricks, and it would not have been as big a blow as the realization that I'd been sending out the message that she was lazy." Sophie then went on to tell me that if she had 10 arms, she could just write and write and write, and all the words would be perfect. She said that her brain has so much it wants to do, but her body was just too lazy, as she put it again. Then Dorothy asked Sophie what she would not want to change about herself. She said that she would always want to be colorful, because I love rainbows so much, and that using one color all the time was boring and lazy. There's that word again. And that using a different color for every letter in a word was exciting to her. That's when I realized that the end result is of no importance to her, Dorothy said. It's all about the process. She had to find her own way to make it more interesting and colorful, and that's what made her happy. Dorothy described her realization as a turning point in their relationship. By shifting her perception from what she thought was a negative to seeing it as a positive, she realized what a gift Sophie possesses. Dorothy soon began presenting a very different mirror for her daughter to look into. Lazy left her vocabulary and her perception. Different children. The children who push our buttons are usually children who are temperamentally more difficult to handle. They can be opposite from us in nature or scarily like us. They threaten our sense of ourselves, who we've learned to be. They disrupt our lives, cause us severe inconvenience, and lead us to question why we ever had children. They force us to look at our buttons and our reactions and demand that we work at this parenting business. They are indeed different, but they need us to know that different doesn't mean wrong. They often experience pain because our cultural system, especially our educational system, doesn't always understand them. These children are trying to tell us that square pegs cannot fit into round holes. Samantha reported that she was having difficulty getting 7-year-old Ethan to read the books his teacher required. "When I tell him it's time to read," Samantha bemoaned, "he shouts at me, says, 'I'm not doing it,' and runs off. If we sit down together to read, he fidgets, makes wild guesses, blows raspberries, fiddles with things, or stares into space." Intending to motivate him to read, Samantha threatened Ethan with writing in his reading journal that he refused to finish his book. Threats do not work with children who don't like being told what to do. Ethan shouted back that he didn't care and was going to rip up the book. As soon as he grabbed the book, Samantha realized what she had provoked. Fortunately, she had learned how to shift gears. She regrouped, breathed deeply, and stepped out of the power struggle. Putting her hands on the book to protect it, Samantha said, "Ethan, I wonder if Mrs. Caveney has picked the wrong book for you. I don't think we should read any more until I talk to her about it. This book doesn't interest you. I'm sorry that I was forcing you to read it." Ethan's whole body relaxed. He let go of the book and said simply, "Okay," and got ready for bed. Samantha was hesitant about questioning a teacher's decisions, but suggested that the books Ethan was being asked to read were too difficult for him. Wanting more success with Ethan herself, his teacher tried a book from a lower level of reading skill. Samantha reported that Ethan is a different child. She saw clearly that his behavior was not defiant, but was the result of feeling unsuccessful. The stress of not being able to keep up with his classmates had been provoking his reactive, angry, sometimes destructive behavior that he took out on his mother, the person with whom he felt safest. Now he sits happily with me for reading, and I've even caught him reading to his little sister. When he's not sure, he guesses at words instead of getting angry and running off. I can see the sense of accomplishment on his face. He even wants to play spelling games on the way to school now. This may sound too good to be true, but it is indeed a true story. Samantha had already learned the language that Ethan responded to, but everything in a child's life presents a new learning curve. She was being influenced by what his teacher was expecting of him rather than listening to his frustrated behavior signals. When she did, she could accept his differences. Ethan's learning style is different from other boys his age. So many children have it much worse than Ethan within a system that doesn't always fit the child's learning style. When we see these children as resistant and oppositional, we all lose. When we see that they need something different and that it's not their fault, the search alone will help them feel more accepted. Lessons from a strong-willed child. Sometimes we get our priorities confused, especially when our buttons get pushed. Much of the time we just want our children to listen and do what we say so we can feel like competent parents. We justify this desire with the societal belief that children need to learn to do what they're told because that's how it will be in the big world. Unintentionally, we create problems when we come up against children who are strong-willed, persistent, sensitive, and unpredictable. Remember, they too want to be successful and to please us, just not in the way we're asking. There's nothing wrong with a child who doesn't like being told what to do. His resistance does not mean he's obstinate and disrespectful. He is simply sensitive to feeling discounted when his parent says, "You have to do what I say." When he says, "No, I don't," he means, "I don't like being talked to that way. I need to understand why I have to do it your way. I can do it when it makes logical sense to me." My daughter Molly gave me a run for my money for the first 7 years of her life. I finally understood and gradually was able to accept her as I learned who she was and what she needed. My learning process took years. Her difficulty with change and transition made our move from New York City to small-town New Hampshire tough for her. We assumed that at age 3 she would forget New York by the end of the first week in New Hampshire, but it took 2 years before New York and New Hampshire were even on the same par. The Christmas of Molly's 5th year and our 2nd year in New Hampshire, Molly had just begun to settle into her new life. Shortly before Christmas, while she was at preschool, her father and I put the Christmas tree in its stand and strung the lights. Being only our 2nd Christmas in the new house, our traditions were not set, and we decided to put the tree in front of the window instead of across the room where it had been the year before. When Molly came home, I ushered her into the living room, anticipating her excitement. In a sudden burst of tears, she blurted out, "It's not Christmas! It can't go there! It has to go over there! You have to move it!" Her fragile new picture of Christmas had been destroyed. She couldn't make the leap to what we perceived as an improvement like her 10-year-old brother could. Her mind worked differently, and it challenged us daily. It would have been easy to say either, "Tough, Moll, this is what the rest of us want," or, "Okay, we'll move it, just don't get so upset." But the fallout would have been great either way. If we had moved the tree to make her happy, the rest of us would have felt victimized by her temperament and resentful of her power. If I had told her it's 3 against 1, she would have held on to the injustice and made our lives miserable. It had to be a win-win. Fortunately, I had learned enough about her to know that she was not being defiant or oppositional. She was simply having a hard time coping with the stress of change. Had I not learned this, she would have borne the brunt of my frustrated wrath, as had often been the case previously. Instead, I took a few deep breaths to shift gears and put my arms around her. "So, moving the Christmas tree makes it not seem like Christmas to you," I said patiently, not having the faintest idea what my next move would be.
"Yes, you can't do that. You have to move it back."
I held her and let the tears come. Buying myself some time, I said, "You know what? I really understand why it feels wrong to you. Last Christmas it was different. Let's wait until the end of the day when we can talk about this with Poppy and Casey. Let's go do something else now. Molly trusted from past experience that it would not be forgotten, and knew that her feelings were taken into account, so she was able to leave the living room. Had it been otherwise, I imagine she would have thrown a major tantrum right there, especially if she thought it would get me to move the tree. I had also learned that she would not forget about it, and I couldn't just sweep the issue under the carpet and hope for the best. We all discussed the tree, and the rest of us clearly wanted it to remain in front of the window. We did some negotiating about her picking out the tree next year or putting colored lights on instead of the all-white, but she still was not sold. That evening, we happened to drive by the front of the house. The lights from the Christmas tree sparkled in the front window. I said, "Look, Mal, look at the lights in the window." We all oohed and aahed, Molly included. She agreed with the rest of us that the tree should stay. Because she trusted we would find a resolution, she had no reason to put up a defense. Feeling understood went a long way toward helping her cope with the change. Otherwise, she wouldn't have agreed, even if she liked the way the lights looked in the window. She wanted to cooperate, but she had to find her own way to do it. It had to make sense to her. Making adjustments for the distractible child. 7-year-old Jackson is impulsive and distractible. He has a hard time sitting still and often makes loud, silly noises when he's bored or unstructured. But take him to the reptile house at the zoo and you can't tear him away. It is, of course, impossible and exhausting for most parents to engage their children's interests at all times. But knowing that distractible brains can completely focus when they're engaged and interested helps parents feel hopeful. Jackson's music class was to be part of the first and second grade recital. There were about 80 children involved. The first graders were to sing a few songs, then sit to the side while the second graders performed before combining for the finale, a situation ripe for a distractible child to misbehave. They practiced for weeks, and Jackson was excited as the recital drew near. His parents had learned a lot about his behavior, but Jackson had been a constant challenge for them. They had come a long way from seeing Jackson as being a problem and misbehaving on purpose to understanding the obstacle he has to work with. As the recital grew close, John assured his son that they would be right there to support him and knew he would do a beautiful job. On the day of the recital, John took a dollar bill from his wallet and gave it to his son, saying, "This is a buck for good luck. Keep it in your shirt sleeve and think about it if you feel uncomfortable. If you start to think you can't go on, hold on to it tightly in your hand. Then, if you know you've had enough, raise the hand with the dollar in it, and one of us will help you off the stage." John was setting his expectations for success. Jackson did succeed in the recital. The dollar bill was tightly crumpled in his fist, and his parents congratulated him on what he'd accomplished with his own effort. When he had something tangible to focus on, Jackson was able to stay on target longer than usual. The roles of fear and doubt. When we can see behavior as an expression of our children's internal state, we can help them cope with their individual struggles, even if we never completely understand what they are. If we truly believe that they want to be successful and are unique and capable in their own way, our fears for their future will diminish. Because we're in charge of these very powerful human beings, we as parents can rarely rid ourselves of fear entirely. It's the hazard of the profession. However, we can own our fear without letting it parent our children. When fear drives our parenting, it prevents us from connecting and knowing our child. It keeps us stuck in our heads, in the past or the future, unable to hear what our child hears. It keeps us in reaction. Doubt, on the other hand, is the barometer by which we can tell whether we're being flexible or inflexible. We all know parents who are cocksure of their parenting. No one can tell them what to do. Not one of us would want to be their child. Unfortunately, many of us were. Doubt keeps us conscious and proactive. Doubt keeps us searching and learning. It keeps us on our toes, unable to dip into complacency and neglect. It allows for mistakes, apologies, and ongoing communication. We will always wonder what to do or if we did the right thing. We all have a line, bendable and sometimes fuzzy, on either side of which we will always teeter. It's the mark of a conscientious parent to be unsure which side of the line to defer to. As long as we don't hold rigidly to the line or fall far from it, we can be sure we're paying attention. Main ideas from Chapter 3. A child's temperament is inborn. It cannot be changed, but can be greatly influenced by a parent both positively and negatively. Acceptance of the whole child is more powerful even than love. Accepting the child is fundamental to making connection and influencing behavior positively. Acceptance of the child does not mean acceptance of the behavior. Children build their identities on the reflection they see of themselves in their parents' eyes. The children most difficult to handle pose threats because they are either opposite in nature or very much like their parent. Button-pushing children teach parents what they most need to learn. Strong-willed children want to cooperate, but not always in the way we want them to. Fear keeps us stuck. Doubt keeps us conscious. Practice. List your child's unique personality characteristics. You may want to use the temperament charts in Mary Sheedy Krasinka's Raising Your Spirited Child. Put a plus sign next to the ones that you like about your child, a check mark next to the ones you find difficult to manage, and a minus sign next to the ones you have concerns about. Each may have more than one mark. List one or two parenting methods that help with the ones checkmarked. Write one positive aspect about the ones marked with a minus. In what areas, if any, can you see now could your child become competent? Write a paragraph or two about your child's individual capabilities. Read it when you're frustrated with her behavior. How well does your child's unique personality fit with your expectations of her? Do you more often find yourself expecting your child to do something wrong or to succeed, rise to an occasion, and be delightful or creative? Is your child accepted in his community, school, friends, relatives? If not, how can you help those perceptions to change? How would you feel if your child wants to do something in life that you do not approve of?